You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So, welcome, you have to excuse my voice, but quick welcome to the Privacy and Security Lunch at CRCS. Always fun when we get to co-host something with Berkman, and I want to thank Chris for setting this up, and Chris will introduce the speaker.
You sound much better.
I have an accent too. So it's my great pleasure to introduce this speaker. I'm really, really happy to be able to bring him here, and I'm very, very thankful that the CS department was able to partner with the Berkman Center and fund Professor Owen. So Paul is a lawyer now, but in a previous incarnation, he was a computer programmer. He's one of only two lawyers that I know who can write Perl and still continues to write Perl. And I think that should give him credibility in this room, although you haven't seen his Perl, so maybe you shouldn't judge him in that way. Because of his background in computer science, he has a unique perspective on issues in the law. And so in the past few years, he's written about some really fascinating topics, including the effect and impact of super users or highly skilled hackers in disseminating exploits and other techniques. He wrote what should be required reading for all computer science students, a paper on the ethics and legality of network monitoring research. He co-wrote that with several of his colleagues at the University of Colorado. If your research involves using TCP dump or Wireshark or any sort of data collection tool involving networking, you need to read this. And if you're a professor teaching a class, you need to get your students to read this, because wiretap law and interception law in the United States is impossible to understand. And anyone in this room would get it wrong based on what their gut feeling is. Oh, it's my network, or it's our network, so we can do this. His paper has caused waves, and I think as the community continues to evolve, that paper will continue to get cited. So today he'll be discussing something very, very interesting, which is the subject of the anonymization and re-identification of data, which I guess first became a big issue in our eyes when AOL released its data set of search terms willingly to help members of the research community in an anonymized way, and then members of the New York Times and others were then able to de-anonymize that data set using people's vanity searches, so Googling for their own names. Since then, we've had Netflix data sets be de-anonymized, and several other data sets that I guess Paul will be discussing. So I think that should give us a start. Please welcome Paul Owen.
Thank you. I've only been mocked once for wearing a suit, but that's just what I have to do. And the part of my biography that Chris left out, no doubt because he tries hard to forget this, is I spent 4 years as a federal prosecutor at the Department of Justice prosecuting computer crime. I was not involved in the search of anyone who is in this room, but that's another part of my history, and that's what really introduced me to this Byzantine wiretap law. And that was only an incomplete story. I mean, it's true your intuitions about what you're allowed to do with your network are probably wrong, but the ridiculous thing about that statute is trained lawyers read the entire thing and they still have the incorrect result about what the law says. It's a horribly mangled statute. I wrote a blog post last year where I threw down the gauntlet and I said, which is the most confusing statute, the Wiretap Act or the tax code? And it was unanimous. My commenter said, no, Wiretap Act, hands down. The tax code is long, but if you study it, you can understand it. This defies understanding. I really do want to thank first Chris for arranging the visit, CRCS and Berkman for hosting it, Alan and Carol Harlow for being really great about helping me set it up. This is a paper that is in a very early stage And for a law professor, and I'm not kidding, that means I've only written 21,000 words so far. And I'm happy to share the paper with anyone who wants to really, really, really dig deeply into this. But the virtue of that is that I really can change everything I'm about to say. So I would love this opportunity to kind of be pushed on my ideas. The talk's really going to progress in three steps. First, I'm going to talk about what I see as how the law regards anonymization of data. And in the same step, how these recent results in computer science suggest that the law may have it wrong. I'm going to do that rather quickly. When I talk to a law audience, I've done this paper two or three times before. When I talk to a law audience, that's where I spend all of my time. In this audience, I think the intuition will come quickly to everyone in the room, even if you haven't read any of these papers. In the second phase, I want to take kind of this layperson lawyer's look at what I get, what I gather from all this computer science research. And then third, what do I think this means for law? And for, in particular, how we regulate privacy both here in the United States and in Europe. So that's kind of the three waves, and hopefully I can get through the first 28 slides pretty quickly, and we can focus on the last three or four. And just to check, we go to 1:30, is that correct? Please interrupt me at any time. And let's get going. Okay, so this talk is about anonymization, which I define in my paper to mean the manipulation of information in the database to make it difficult, difficult's really the important word there, to identify the subjects of the data. And as a really, really simple example, this example is based actually on a sample data set that LaTanya Sweeney, who I understand is visiting here this semester, has in a couple of her papers, simulating a database full of diagnoses of individuals. The names on the left I supplied, and I'll give a free cookie in the back of the room to anyone who could decipher where those names come from. So I pause and let you stare at them for a second. Okay, so this is the data. And when people think about anonymization, and 10 years ago, I don't think this was an over-exaggeration, they thought of this, right? So you remove the names and you're left with useful data that can be used for all sorts of beneficial research and analysis, but the individuals represented by the data are supposedly protected. And if you immediately see the flaw in that reasoning, then you already understand the intuition on the computer science research I'm going to describe. But let's put that off for a second. Why? Why do people anonymize? So why do data holders anonymize? In the legal literature, and in other literature, you know, we've taken to talking about four reasons why we do everything online, and they apply equally in this case. So we sometimes anonymize because we feel it's the ethical thing to do. If I'm going to share the data with someone else, I should lop off those names to protect them. It's ethics. It's morality. The second is the market, right? We can have an interesting conversation about whether your customers would care whether or not they would be re-identifiable in the data, and more to the point, whether they would make pricing decisions, payment decisions based on that. Architecture is a really important one. So sometimes we anonymize because some coder who was kind of barely thinking about the issue flipped a switch that created a level of anonymization. The example I always give for this is the Apache web server, when you first install it, makes all these decisions about what goes in the standard log file and what doesn't. And therein provide a little bit of anonymization and privacy that they didn't necessarily have to provide. But the one that, of course, is the focus of this paper, because I am a law professor, is law. Law plays a pretty significant role, it turns, in motivating people to anonymize. And I'm going to spend a few slides explaining what I mean by that. This will be reviewed, especially to the lawyers in the room, about kind of a quick two-sentence summary of how we regulate privacy both here and in Europe. This is the standard story, and for the purposes of today's talk, it's sufficiently accurate to use. In the United States, we regulate privacy sectorally. So we figure that there is one particular privacy problem, a potential privacy harm in one sector, in one industry, in one type of transaction, and we regulate it with a very narrow statute. This alphabet soup represents four examples. HIPAA is the health privacy statute, the prevailing one under federal law. These are all federal laws. FERPA is the law that regulates student privacy in federally funded institutions. It's why you cannot post student names and their grades on a website. The Fair Credit Reporting Act, you've all had some interaction with, the Child Online Privacy Protection Act. These are sectoral. Of course, the story that's always told, and it's pretty much an accurate story, is why do we do this? We do this because Congress only acts when they've heard a really good story, right? And so two statutes that aren't on there are the two that are always given as examples. Rebecca Schaefer was an actress who was murdered because someone tracked her down using DMV data. And so now we have the Drivers Privacy Protection Act, the DPPA. And then the much more famous one that's relevant later in the talk is when Judge Bork was a nominee for the Supreme Court. Some intrepid journalists went down to his neighborhood video rental store and found out the movies he was renting. So as a result of that, we have the Video Privacy Protection Act. Turns out he wasn't renting porn, but I think he rented The Sound of Music multiple times, which was enough to impugn him. In the Department of Justice, we'd like to comment that it was easier for us to obtain the entire contents of your email inbox than a list of the movies you'd rented at the video rental place. And that's accurate because of this idiosyncratic way that Congress regulates privacy. And again, I'm painting with a broad brush, but Congress tends to be entirely harm-centric. They focus on individuals, they imagine how they will be harmed. That imagination game is easier when they have a salient example sitting across from them, and then they regulate. So the European model, in contradistinction here, we have omnibus directives. Most famously, we have the Data Protection Directive, which applies to all sorts of entities that possess personal information. And so it crosses industries, it crosses types of transactions, types of customers and users, and it comes much more from a right-centric view of privacy. In their Charter on Human Rights, the European Union has a declaration that says privacy is one of the enumerated human rights. And from that slightly different worldview flows a really, really different sort of regulatory regime. Okay. But the claim I want to make, and this distinction I think is important to keep in mind, but the claim I want to make is regardless of where we are, our privacy laws assume, they make this fundamental assumption that anonymization techniques are robust. That once you remove enough sensitive information from your data, you have protected the identity of the individuals in the data, and you no longer fall under government regulation. They treat the world as if there's a binary situation. Data is anonymized, it's unregulated, data is not anonymized, it's regulated. The word itself, I argue in the paper, lends itself to this sort of regulation. Right? The word anonymized has this connotation of success. You are anonymous because they anonymized. And that's what I argue lawmakers do. Let me be a little more specific. Here are two forms of regulatory structure that I identify in the paper that embed this binary view of anonymization. One I call the sensitivity sort. Statutes make all sorts of distinctions between sensitive data and data that's heavily regulated, and not sensitive data, data that's not regulated at all. I think the research in computer science will suggest that that is a little bit less of an important distinction than we think. But the really easy one to understand is statutes will often talk about whether or not your data directly or only indirectly relates to people. Here's an example. This is the student privacy law I talked about earlier, FERPA. This is only a partial definition. This is part of the definition of the type of data regulated. And here's the critical phrase. Education records mean information directly related to a student. And so if you're a university and you have removed, and they don't define that in any greater depth, you've removed names, social security numbers, maybe retained kind of the unique numbers that you sometimes assign to students. I think university counsel would argue that you have a pretty good argument that you're now outside of this statute altogether. And maybe I'm wrong on that. I'm not a FERPA expert.
Guidelines from Leroy Rooker of the Department of Ed on that is the student ID cannot be used.
Okay, so student ID cannot be used, and that's no doubt.
He spends a lot of time talking about your particular issue, and the regulations were strengthened a couple of months ago.
In light of the new advances. That's fascinating. I definitely want to hear more about that. And so there are lots of laws that do this, that talk about direct relationships between people and their data. So what's happened, we've had these advances in re-identification. This started in the study of statistical databases. It was primarily statisticians More recently, the data mining folks and the algorithm people have all come together. What's the basic premise? The basic premise is this, right? So you've got this database over here that's anonymized. You have this bit of outside information, and you bring them together to re-identify the individuals. They have two key concepts that really start to sound a lot like a cryptography discussion. They imagine the adversary having access to outside information. And that outside information can be quite rich, right? I mean, in a lot of this research, the deck is often considered stacked for the adversary because there's all sorts of information they can use to re-identify people. I'm going to go through the three examples very quickly, and Chris has already teed up two of them. So August 3rd, 2006, America Online Research posted this huge file to its website. This is the quote from the README. We have 20 million web queries collected from 650,000 users over 3 months. The data is sorted by anonymous user ID. That, of course, is quite important for the utility of the data, because it's nice to know that the person who searched for Honda searched for Accord a few minutes later. But it was also the fateful decision that caused as much pain as AOL experienced. You know, those of you in the room who only paid scant attention to this may be asking, well, what's AOL research? I don't know about that arm. That's because this was the big coming out party for this entity in AOL. This was the first day they announced their new website and their new researchers.
The
birth and death party. Within a week, they had fired everyone from the CTO down three levels. And to this day, AOL Research no longer has a presence on the web. I don't know if it still exists internally. In my paper, I talk about these anonymous IDs as sad little badges of infamy because these numbers have come to take on so much meaning because bloggers around the world made it a sport to do one of two things. One, find the really chilling stuff in the data, or two, try and re-identify people. So here's three examples of the chilling stuff. And again, most of you have seen these examples. Someone searched for depression and medical leave. Someone searched for fear that spouse was contemplating cheating. And then we had someone search successfully for how to kill your wife, pictures of dead people, car crash photo. You know, we could pause for a moment, and maybe at the end we can have this conversation. As a ex-law enforcement official, would I consider this sufficient evidence to follow up with a subpoena to America Online to figure out a little bit more about this user? I don't know if I personally would have done it. I don't know if that's a good use of an FBI agent's time, but I can argue that within the law, that absolutely is relevant enough to satisfy the requirements for a government subpoena. So it at least gives me the right to peer a little bit more into their private lives. Did the Department of Justice do this? Did any state law enforcement official do this? Not to my knowledge. I haven't seen any prosecutions that have flowed directly from this. I think the government, this may be hard for some of you to believe, I think the government's savvy enough to know that this might be a PR nightmare. But if there was something in there about sarin or anthrax or terrorist attacks, you better believe that there was some follow-up conversation.
There were some other very interesting
searches in that. So, you know, and so maybe that the government has done this, but they're weighing, you know, very carefully whether to make it public through a indictment or a prosecution. But that's not really the interesting part of the story. For me, the much more interesting part of the story are the people who through their search queries, left trails that could be used to re-identify them. Hundreds had entered credit card numbers, social security numbers, phone numbers, and street addresses. Right? The obvious response is, well, it's probably not their phone number or street address. But then the counter response is, doesn't matter, it still gets us pretty close to who they are. This person in particular, this next person did not understand what a search engine was, so this was one of his queries. Does anyone know Stanley who might have a sister? And I've actually anonymized the data. Named first and last name. I've been looking for my family for a very long time. Please let's learn about each other. And then he provides his AOL login name. And so for a while, a couple of bloggers responded and said, this is really useful research information. And I don't quibble with that at all. It is. This is the kind of information that many of the people probably in this room have had years and years and years of trouble obtaining. And so I'm sympathetic to that, but some of those people said, and until someone's re-identified, I don't care. As far as I'm concerned, this person is instantly re-identified by this one search. But of course, we didn't even need to rely on that person because user 4417749 had typed in searches like Lilburn, Georgia, people with the last name of Arnold. and homes sold in Shadow Lake Subdivision, Gwinnett County, Georgia, to intrepid reporters from the New York Times, probably with access to data that an average citizen doesn't have ready access to, I admit that. In about 2 days, found the person who had typed in this data, called her on the telephone, confirmed that she indeed had typed in these search queries, flew down and took a picture of her. And if nothing else, I think this is what is going to make this story have long policy impact. Because I think it was August 9th of 2006, the readers of the New York Times woke up and above the fold on the front page, they saw a picture of Thelma Arnold being kissed by her dog. One of the search queries she had typed in was the dog that urinates on everything. And I think this is why. This is the salience. This is the exclamation point that was put on this particular study. I put the AOL study first because in some sense I think it's the least interesting for where I want to get. But let me pause because I've been talking for too long. Does anyone have any questions so far? Okay.
Do you want to mention that AOL wasn't the first company to do this?
There was a couple of other releases.
Other search engines back before AOL was popular had done this. And this, you know, this was a service to the research community.
Yeah, no doubt. And in fact, those, I think, did not end up having, I mean, maybe the blogosphere was, you know, a lot less focused and a lot less, there was some, but what there was, you know, wasn't as so focused on these collaborative experiments as they are now. But you're right. And I want to underscore that, and I know some of you, I know I'm meeting with some people in Berkman later about how some of these results might impact research. That's really the hardest part of the story for me. Right, because everything I'm going to say toward the end about regulating privacy will make the life of a researcher much more difficult. And so, you know, throughout this, I'd love to have that conversation. Yes.
Is there anything that prevented AOL from reducing that data not anonymized?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. The Electronic Communications Privacy Act. I mean. Again, so that's the statute that includes the indecipherable part of the Wiretap Act. It has a completely separate chapter, which is just as hard to decipher, called the Stored Communications Act. And so it is dangerous for someone who hasn't looked at the Stored Communications Act in the last 2 days to make any public pronouncement on what it says. But if you are a provider to the public, as AOL is, under that particular statute, your ability to release information by your users is pretty restricted.
Unless you said something on your privacy statement.
Yeah, there's a consent exception, but the consent exception, I mean, I wrote an entire other article about how ISPs basically don't have the valid consent of any of their users when it comes to this particular statute. So let me put it this way. They would have been sued. The suit would not have been dismissed on the first day. Maybe it would have been sued, dismissed after 2 years and $15 million in lawyers' fees. But it would have been a significant legal risk for them to do that. So it wasn't just ethics, probably, that motivated the anonymization they did. Right? Yes?
I have an international question, since I'm from Europe.
Okay.
Do these laws only apply to data sets that are created in the U.S.?
Right.
Or do they also apply to data sets that are, for instance, created in Europe?
The laws that I'm talking about focus on the location of the provider. So if
the location of the provider is important,
No. So I don't care where the data was born. If it relates to a provider, if it's possessed and then released by a provider in the United States, it's probably going to fall under this law. I use the word probably because I'm a lawyer, right? That's what we do. We get paid by the probably. But yeah, I mean, the definition of the statute is data, information about a user or subscriber. Right? There's no constraint in there whatsoever for the birth, death, importation, export of the data. It's information about your users or subscribers. So if it's Yahoo possessing the Yahoo France database, yeah, I think they probably consider it regulated. And of course, it's regulated by French law as well. So this is this messy world that I actually was happy enough to get here early enough to hear David Post talking yesterday. And it's not too glib a summary to say that Post takes from what I just said as the reason why none of these laws should apply and we should just start from a clean slate because it's too complicated. Yes?
Relative to research, the impact on research, researchers frequently get data which is non-de-identified.
Yeah.
That's the phrase in the
such an elegant term phrase, yeah.
They frequently get that and sometimes de-identify and work with, and sometimes work with a non-de-identified, understanding that it has to be kept confidential.
Yeah, I mean, there's this also, I work for a state institution, and as you can imagine, these laws regulate the behavior of state actors much more stringently than private actors.
We got some data here at Harvard from a state agency, which said that if we did not properly protect it, it could be jail time for the investigator.
Yeah, and I'm talking about the reverse problem, which is even worse, and you happily don't have this problem, which is, in a strange sense, every computer scientist on my campus, I think, is treated under the law exactly like an FBI agent, right? They're an arm of the state, right? They work for the state of Colorado. You can make a very vigorous, good argument based on academic freedom, based on the unique role of the university, that they're particular beings and they fall outside the statute, but that's just an argument, it's not necessarily a winner.
And you're a lawyer.
And I'm a lawyer. Okay, let's go on to LaTonya Sweeney's study. So I'm not doing these chronologically. LaTonya Sweeney's study in the mid-90s was the one that really woke people up to this, and this, again, is her data. And at the time, she thought that doing that was insufficient. This isn't the live data, but this is all based on what the Health Insurance Agency for the state of Massachusetts had done at the time. The Health Insurance Agency was collecting diagnoses data about every single state employee in the state of Massachusetts. Why were they doing that? Because obviously it was important for figuring out premiums and negotiating with providers. And they realized, this data is so useful to us internally, why don't we unleash this database to the public? And the quote I've heard attributed to then-Governor Weld, although I haven't run down a news article about this yet, is Governor Weld went to a podium and said, "We're releasing this, it's a great boon for research. You need not worry about your privacy because it's impossible to figure out who these individuals are." Right? And this was the amount, all of the fields I've represented here were in that released data set. Okay, so what LaTonya Sweeney did, then a punchy graduate student at Harvard, said, "Well, I think you're giving me too much, and in particular birthday, sex, and zip code seem to be an awfully, not unique, but awfully identifying trio of information." But really, and this is one of these claims, at several points in this talk, I'm going to make a claim that I haven't completely researched about the computer science, and so if I'm wrong, please tell me. The sense I get about the Sweeney study, the Netflix study, and the AOL study is even computer scientists at the leading edge of this field were genuinely surprised by how easy this all turned out to be. How easy was it? The question Sweeney asked is, how many people living in your zip code share both your birthday and sex? Or if we allow for some anonymization, typical anonymization, what if we only give you the city instead of the zip code? What if we only give you the county instead of the zip code? And her result was surprising. 87% of Americans in the 1990 census data were completely uniquely identifiable if you only had those three pieces of information. Mm. And the critical one, of course, seems to be, well, maybe she wouldn't put it this way, but I think the critical one seems to be birth date, right? Because you've got 365 or 6 per year over 100 years of life. That's a fairly identifiable piece of information right there. City birthday and sex, 53%. County birthday and sex, 18%. This was a big eye-opener for everyone who handles data, because these types of information were routinely included in databases that were traded back and forth. And Dr. Sweeney was deeply influential in what flowed directly from this, which was HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. And as you read that statute and as you read Dr. Sweeney's testimony, you realize that her words were translated directly into law. And these statistics loom large in that particular law. So Governor William Weld, in every one of these studies, they give you the study, and then they give you the salient example that makes this study memorable. She said, "Well, Governor William Weld has assured us privacy. Let me see if I can find Governor William Weld in this database, because he's a state employee." And so what did she do? She knew he was a resident of Cambridge, Massachusetts. At the time, a population of 54,000 with 7 zip codes. For $20, I've seen this cited as $15 elsewhere. At the time, you could buy the entire voter rolls for the city of Cambridge, which included every single individual's name, birth date, zip code, and sex. And so that's why at the beginning I said this is all this research really entails. So she bought that for $20 and quickly learned that there were 6 with his birth date, only 3 of them were men, and only 1 of them lived in his zip code.
And then she took it a step further, and she printed out all of his diagnoses onto a sheet of paper and sent it to the governor's office. And as I understand, was actually investigated by the state's police for a tiny little bit. Which was completely an example of government missing the point entirely. And so again, salient exclamation point that brought this to the attention. And this continues to be cited. A researcher at Microsoft Research has rerun the numbers, and he says that it's actually 63%, not 87%. They're both, I think, larger than intuition would suggest. But I want to run down, if I can, why the discrepancy. Okay, so what does Dr. Sweeney suggest? So basically, an important claim I need to make throughout this paper is I am not saying that everything that falls under the banner of anonymization is re-identifiable. And I'm not saying anonymization is broken. And I'm not saying researchers can never trade data. So, of course, we could do this, right? And now we have what I think even Dr. Sweeney, after running the numbers, would say is perfectly anonymized information. Nothing is ever perfectly anonymized, but good enough for government work, as they say. The cost here, of course, is utility, right? And so one of the important results I'm going to discuss later on is this relationship between utility and strength of anonymization. That if you want your data to be very, very hard to re-identify, then you also have to sacrifice tons of utility. And that's a really interesting trade-off when it comes to questions about how we should respond as policymakers. This is what the HIPAA privacy rule does, which is what Dr. Sweeney, like I said, influenced. If you do this, you get a free pass under that statute. So if you convert all of the birth dates to birth years, and you remove two and sometimes three digits of the zip code, you fall outside the statute completely. Dr. Sweeney has calculated that with this technique, 0.04% of the American population is still re-identifiable. My guess, although I haven't seen this written down, is they tend to be older and they tend to live in rural zip codes. So Congress and the Department of Health and Human Services made a policy decision that 0.04% was an acceptable risk. And you know, it's not really the role of the paper to second guess the decision they made, but to point out that they did make this risk assessment, which of course may be entirely appropriate for health privacy, wildly overprotected for financial privacy, and underprotected for things like AIDS, HIV diagnoses. But they made that decision, they made that calculation. Questions about that part? Okay. Before I leave this, I want to point out Dr. Sweeney's key innovation here. She realized that in this data set, the problem on the one I have on the screen, the problem are these two people, because despite the fact that we're in the HIPAA birth year, we still have, with full zip codes, I should say, sorry, this isn't HIPAA, we still have two people who can uniquely be identified based on those three pieces of information. They're the only people in my limited data set. So she advocates doing this. A much more limited generalization of just the data you need to guarantee that with all of the, what she calls, quasi-identifier information, you still can't pick out anyone. She calls this K-anonymity. With K equal to 2 here, that no matter what four pieces of information you put together in those columns, you're still not going to ever find a unique record. You may find two, which is why it's K-anonymity, but you're never going to find one. So that's what she, and of course the benefit here is we mess with the data less, and so we maximize the utility of the data. Okay. The Netflix price study is the third one, and in some ways I think may have the most interesting ramifications for policy. The Netflix prize is the Netflix Corporation releasing a massive database containing the ratings records for hundreds of thousands of its users. What do I mean by that? I mean that anytime any user attributed, you know, rated a movie from 1 to 5, this database will include the number, the anonymized number of that user, the movie they rated, the number they gave in the rating, and the date on which they rated. Any guess about where these 10 movies come from? I gave this talk once and they said, your 10 favorite movies. And I said, actually, no.
the 10
highest grossing films of all time. Why did Netflix release this data? I'm just going to go into this for a couple of seconds because it goes to the research use. Right, of course, their entire business model is premised on their ability to know that if you liked this movie and that movie, you will also like movie number three. And if they could throw that in front of you on the page when you log in, you're likely to rent it, they're likely to have a happy customer. And so with their internal research, their Cinematch algorithm is pretty good. But they realize if they crowdsource this, it could be better. So they have $1 million bounty to the first team that can improve on their algorithm by 10%. And again, by all accounts, many, many people in the stats community are ecstatic to have access to this kind of information. It's the kind of granular microdata, user intention, user behavior information that's very hard to obtain. And a lot of the techniques that they're applying to this problem are techniques that they haven't applied so rigorously before this. So at the end of the day, is the net gain in research more than the net loss in privacy? Perhaps. But there is a loss in privacy because two researchers at the University of Texas looked at this data and, again, they said, you know, I think that these are fingerprints. I think that if I happen to know that you were lukewarm about Titanic and you hated Dark Knight and you hated Star Wars, if I know enough of that information, I can fingerprint you and pull you out of this database. And their conjecture was, and then I learn a lot about a lot of other movies that you've seen and rated, right? And the intuition makes the most sense at this end of the spectrum. Any guesses about what these are? According to Wikipedia, the 10 worst grossing movies of all time, Zizek's Road apparently made $30 in the American box office before. So here's the intuition, right? So if you know that someone saw Head, much less hated it, and saw Shade and hated it a little bit less, right? That should suggest that this person springs from the database immediately and we re-identify them. But the problem and the key to the study is we have this, right? We have 100 million ratings for 480,000 users with 18,000 movies, and it turns out that there is much more uniqueness and variation from user to user than intuition, even the intuition of very smart people, would have suggested. So here's only one of their results. If I know the exact rating you've given to a movie, and I know the approximate date on which you rated, not viewed, but rated that movie, so these both involve guesses, I can re-identify 99.9% of the people if all I know is 8 of the movies that you've rated, the date within a 14-day error, so in other words, like the rough month that you made that rating, the exact rating, but that's not as hard as it seems, because if I know you've gushed about these movies, then you probably gave them 5s. With that information, I can identify 99.9% of the people. And this is whether or not you're on my first slide with Star Wars or my second slide with Zizek's Road. So if I know this information about you, about very, very, very popular movies that everyone in the database has rated, I still can pluck you out because it's enough of a fingerprint. And 6 of 8 signifies that I can be completely wrong about 2 of them. The algorithm is insensitive to errors like that. And this is also important because it means that even if Netflix injects noise into their database, I'm still going to be just about as successful. You know, you go to the other end of the graph, if I know 2 movies with exact ratings and approximate dates, I'm still above 40%. 40% of the people are uniquely identified just by 2 of their movies. And if I narrow the time window into plus or minus 3 days, I'm close to 80% re-identification. Okay, so that's the end of kind of my layperson's tromp through these papers. The best part of this research is just not having to read law papers, but having to read computer science papers for a while. But any questions about this? All right, here's where hopefully I can make mistakes, and you guys can tell me where I'm making mistakes. I want to first talk about the 4 lessons I import from this literature, right? And I will say, I mean, I'm going to put a marker down. This is where I move from an objective retelling of someone else's story to my story. And so I need to know if you think these are off, and then we'll apply this to law. The first is what I've said multiple times, that these results represent a genuine shift, that there has been a genuine expression of surprise at the ease with which all of these researchers I've described have re-identified people. Why is this important to me? It's marginally important when we're talking about going to Congress and asking them to fix this, whatever that means. Because the message we're sending is, you fools, for a generation you've been regulating incorrectly. No, the message is something has changed. That something fundamental has been revealed by computer scientists that even they didn't understand before. And so you've been regulating under their prior preconceptions, and it's time to maybe rethink those preconceptions because they're wrong.
Well,
yeah.
So how does that contrast to situations where Congress is regulating in situations where computer scientists say that they're idiots? So DRM being the best example, right? Every DRM scheme is known to be inherently flawed by everyone in the computer science field. Every time someone breaks it, it's not a surprise, but yet Congress continues to pass laws in this area.
I threw in the word marginal when I was describing this. I mean, it all goes into this entire stew of political choice, right? And there's a lot of theory about how laws get made in this country. And, you know, the very simplistic version is, well, it's whatever the lucrative industries want, they get, right? But in the course of telling Congress to change things, it's always interesting to look at where all of your ammunition is. And one thing I think would be helpful to express to Congress is, you haven't been wrong, right? To kind of soothe their egos a little bit. To spur them into action, to say, we need a moment where we look at revisit every one of our privacy laws, not because you've been making a mistake for two generations, but because something has changed. So I think this is all in the realm of atmospherics, right? I'm not suggesting that I post this paper on a Tuesday and then on Thursday congressional hearings are held. But in the world of atmospherics, I think it's helpful to make it clear to these lawmakers that we're talking about something that's changed. And that's why, again, this slide is my conclusion. I want to be right that something has changed. And at the very end, my last slide is what I need from the computer science community. And the first question is, what has changed? Because that really, I haven't seen that yet. The second one is one that I've named, called the accretion problem. They talk about this a little bit in the Netflix paper. But the idea here is that because of the interesting interplay of outside information and the dominant role it plays in all of these stories, we have an accretion of privacy risk over time. That every time something gets put anywhere, our risk of a privacy revelation and then a privacy harm increase. Right? So one way that Narayanan put this, and Shmatikov, the Netflix authors, put it in their paper, is beware the cocktail party where someone says, oh, let's list our five favorite obscure movies of all time. You can never have that conversation for the rest of time if you're worried about your preferences in the Netflix database being revealed. You may not worry about that, but if you're worried at all, you can't have that conversation. So you are now standing kind of a little bit closer to whatever precipice we can define a privacy harm because of the way outside information comes into play. Is there a question? Yeah.
I was just going to say that those two statements taken together say that the real death knell of either privacy or where the legislation has to go is social networking.
Yes.
That's the place where I have that cocktail party conversation in full view of.
Yes, and virtually every one of these papers that's come out in the last 2 or 3 years has made that point. They've said, and oh, by the way, if I really, really wanted to be aggressive or devious or whatever word you put on it about this, I'm going to go mine the social networks. Because how many people have talked about movies they liked on their Facebook page, right? Or even in their blog, right? Or on Twitter, right? And so you're right. I think that's right. People, and so, boy, I haven't yet dipped my toe into that world because I now define it as kind of the privacy scholar's litmus test. What do you do about social networks? Because if you're a paternalist, you're gonna reveal your paternalist stripes. If you're a defeatist about the whole project, you're gonna reveal your defeatist. It's just such a hard problem for privacy law scholars. You're right, and so that's exactly it. So turning to information theory, Narayanan expresses this in terms of entropy. There are 6 billion people on Earth, so we are all defined by 33 bits of entropy, which is how we get to 6 billion. Every time I learn a little bit more about you, I whittle away a few of the bits. And so if I know that you, the anonymized person, live in a town of 10,000, I've now gone from 33 bits, everyone in the world, down to 13 bits, the people in your town. And so I like that image, right? I picture us all as it relates to the one database out there where we would be ruined if the data were ever revealed. I imagine that there's this tiny little invisible list of bits on your forehead that reveal how close the adversaries of the world are to finding your secret, your terrible secret. And I think policy should take that into account. right? That even the release of innocuous benign data should matter because of this entropy notion and this accretion problem. Okay, two other results that are related. So Cynthia Dwork at Microsoft has done some really, really amazing fundamental research in this, theoretical research, where and I have to confess, I do not understand the set theory, and I've read it 100 times. But I understand the part before and the part after, so hopefully I'm translating it correctly. But her conjecture, and I think she proves it formally, others have told me she proves it formally, is that it's impossible to attain perfect anonymization. That for every database that's ever been published, you can imagine the perfect outside information that will re-identify the people in that database, right? That not only are these two, utility and anonymization, related, but they're in a sense at war with one another. And that as soon as you add one single bit of utility to that data, you've blown the chance at perfect anonymization. But I have to reiterate what I said earlier. I think Dwork and everyone else would still say, no, but there's some anonymization that's so good that we shouldn't worry about the risk, but we have to stop our complacency in assuming that there is no risk. There's always risk. And then, you know, much more to the point, there's this proportionality concept. And this one I see explored less in the literature, so I would love pointers to this. That not only are these related concepts, but they're proportionally related. That as one goes down, the other goes up. Okay. All right, so those are my kind of layperson's reinterpretation of this research. But here's where we start turning to where I'm a little bit more qualified to speak. So what should law do about this, right? Yeah, please. Yeah.
You're focusing a lot on uniqueness. Because you need to identify a person, and that was the problem. So you get percentages on what percentage you can identify someone.
Yeah.
Why is that sort of magic, oh, that's a problem, but if I can tell it's one of two people, we're not worried about that?
Yes, so, you know, the paper that brings us to home is this follow-on paper to Dr. Sweeney's work, where he says, no, it's not 87% of the people in the country that are re-identified, it's only 63. He then has a series of graphs where he shows exactly your point, that even if you're in the lucky 37% of relatively private people, the number of people that are too anonymous is significantly higher. And by the time you get to 5 anonymity, the graph is a straight line, a perfectly unique, with a huge dip from ages 18 to 21, going back up and going back to birth. Any guesses why?
College students.
Yeah, the only people in America who can hide based on birth date, zip code, and sex are people who live in College Station, Texas, and Ann Arbor, Michigan, and in a couple other places where there happen to be lots of people who share your birth date and your sex. But you're right, that's an important point. I thought you were going another way with this, which is Narayanan has this blog where he talks about all the stuff he would write about if he had time, and he talks about the fallacy of group privacy, right? The fallacy of saying, applying the lessons here of individuals to groups. So there's a famous study of a high school in the 90s, I think, where the researchers did a complete social networking graph of everyone who had sex with everyone. And they published the anonymized pictures of the graphs, not of the sex, of the graphs, that show that, you know, there's a huge cluster over here, and there are these two people over here. And so what Narayanan says is, are you kidding me, right? You couldn't have known better back then, but you've given me so much information. I can tell you what this high school is, you know, within a few minutes of research, especially with social networks. I don't think Narayanan, Chris and I are talking about, I don't know if he's turned this into a paper, but I'm pretty convinced he knows the name of the high school. He just hasn't released it yet. In that. And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's a really important study. But he's just pointing out that in the last 10 years we've learned to do it differently. Okay, other questions about my list of conclusions here? Yes?
So in this differential privacy line of work,
yeah,
there has been
proportionality
between the amount of error that you need to add to statistics in order to achieve quantifiable.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, there's an entire countermeasure literature out there that I haven't put on the slides, but I engage in the paper, right? And so, and there almost seem to be, I mean, God, I'm outside this world, so I don't want to make too many guesses, but there seem to be kind of competing theories about how you go about this. Do you generalize and suppress data on the one hand? Do you add noise on the other hand? Obviously, some are better for some applications than others. There's an arms race, And arms races is squarely in the middle of what I find interesting about law and policy. Right? When we regulate arms races, why do we do it and when should we do it? People are afraid of making predictions about who's going to win an arms race, but I think we should be less afraid of that as regulators. And so this is a test case. I mean, I have this intuition that the re-identifiers may have the upper hand, at least for some applications. Let me put it that way. But I didn't even put that on the slide because that's not rigorous yet. That's just an intuition. How can we respond? Here's four ways to respond, okay? We can ban re-identification. And some notable researchers and privacy advocates have asked for exactly this, right? So the federal, Re-Identification Prohibition Act of 2009, right? It becomes name your poison, civil liability, federal misdemeanor, federal felony to do this act, right? And I see a lot of you shaking your heads, and I'm with you. I mean, what I say in the paper is, like, there's two objections you could lodge to banning re-identification. The first is just the DMCA objection, right? This is so inchoate from the harm that you're worried about that you're basically punishing math, right? I mean, that's the first one. That one hasn't had a lot of traction in the DMCA debate, but I think there are sympathies there. The second objection, I think, is the one that really has legs, which is this is a particularly hard thing to regulate out of existence. And I think it's harder in some sense than digital rights management circumvention. Why? The theory that I'm starting to develop is this is an act. If you're on the black hat side of this, if what you're doing is buying an anonymized database from Amazon and then re-identifying the people in that database in order to squeeze additional nickels out of that data, that is something that you can easily do in private and reap the benefits and the profits in private, right? So if DRM circumvention was something that could only be done in private, or maybe within small circles, dark nets of people, my guess is we wouldn't have a DMCA today. But it's the fact that it's tied so closely to a public release that concerns content industries. This one doesn't have to be tied to some great public release in order to be pernicious and pervasive. And so I think just in terms of the futility of this approach, I don't reject it out of hand, but I say, go ahead and do it, but I think you're going to be wasting a lot of resources if you do. We could talk more about that. I mean, I think in a strange sense, it's not the DMCA. Because, right, this statute, we're going to carve out academic research, and that's going to be a hard thing to do, but we're going to carve it out. We're going to carve out criminal law enforcement, because we always do. Maybe we'll carve out civil litigants trying to assert their rights. Maybe we'll carve out Google accidentally anonymizing something they shouldn't have and needing to re-identify. And we're going to be left with the bad actors, right? The marketers, the identity thieves. Those are the people who are going to be left. So in a strange sense, I don't think the lobbying pressure is going to line up the same way it did with the DMCA. With the DMCA, we have poster children for people who we want to circumvent DRM. I think the poster children are going to be fewer and have a much more quiet voice on the re-identification ban debate. Yeah.
Don't identity thieves already break the law?
Yeah, right.
What's the benefit of making something that they do even more legal?
Well, it's a step earlier, right. So it's now attempted identity theft, right? So we have a larger pool of people. It's no longer go into Amazon and buy a book. It's now, it's the burglar tool possession, basically. Right?
So me having a copy of the DMV data set that the DMV sells to me,
yes.
Even though the DMV can legally sell it to me the minute I possess it, if they can prove that I'm not a researcher, I'm now having burglary tools.
So when I said that the poster children would be lonelier and less hard to justify, I don't doubt that some will line up behind them nevertheless, and I have the feeling you'll be one of those. But I do think it's a different story, right? I mean, with the DMCA, right, who are your poster children? They're not the guy who accidentally intentionally takes the DMV database and finds the identity of the people. You know, it's people who want to use fair use. It's people who want to enjoy their content. They're the type of group that Congress cares a lot more about, right, than the accidental almost researcher. Right, and so I'm not saying you're wrong, but I'm just saying I think the story is going to be easier to tell. Alan, did you have a response, or is it similar? Okay, so that's the first response, and again, I don't hold a lot of hope for that response. The second one I is the only one I dismiss outright, which is just we use this as the final nail in the coffin to this entire enterprise of protecting privacy, and we surrender, right? We throw our hands up and we say, this is the fifth time, the sixth time, the hundredth time that we've proved the futility of trying to regulate privacy. So instead, we just, you know, give ourselves up to a world without privacy, right? And the leading proponent of this, to caricature him a little bit, is David Brin's Transparent Society, where he says, in a world with technology that can do things like this, rather than try and regulate this out of existence, we should turn the telescope around and use it to figure out what the government and what corporations are doing to us. The problem there, of course, is the power imbalance. They'll always be able to get away with things that we can't. So I do not ascribe to this one at all. Right? I don't see this as right. The third one, I think, is a much more problematic one for me to tackle, which is just strengthen harm prevention, detection, and punishment. Right? So you could hear my entire paper and my talk and say, you've convinced me that we're about to unleash a new, we're about to empower a new wave of all sorts of harms that we don't have today. But they're going to be just like the harms that we've had yesterday. There's just going to be more of them. Right? So more people who are HIV positive are going to have their identities revealed. And more people, you know, you just name your privacy poison, there's going to be more of it. And so the response would be, just hire more FBI agents. And strengthen penalties or enhance penalties. And so accept the world where more people are harmed and go about trying to deter them in other ways. I find that almost a close cousin to the prior, giving yourself up to this. I mean, I think the ease of re-identification is so significant, and the accretion problem is one that Congress should care about so much, that I think strengthening harm prevention is not enough. And, you know, that one statement has a lot of normative work behind it that I have to do. But I don't think this is enough. I think we need to go further. And specifically, I think we need to change the way we regulate privacy. We need to revisit every privacy statute here and abroad to consider the ways in which we've written statutes that are broken. Let me give you some general points, and then I'm going to give you six specific prescriptions. Okay, the first thing we need to do, and I've already hinted at this, is we just need a grammar change. So we need to, I think there's more important than you may think. I think we need to disabuse Congress people of the thought that what is happening here is anonymization, because that suggests the conclusion. That suggests success. And what we really want to do is connote effort, right? So we need a word that says, I've done something to this database, and I have applied a lot of mathematical principles, and I think it's hard to re-identify those people. The best word I could come up with so far is scrub, because I don't think it has that connotation of success. Right? You can scrub things vigorously, you can scrub them a little. It's also got the virtue of being a word that technologists tend to use. Right? That's what you do when you're playing with data. The downside is I don't think it's sufficiently sophisticated for the halls of Congress. Right? And so I'm searching around for a better word, but that's the word I have. But again, sanitize has the same problem as anonymize, as far as I'm concerned. The word that's used most often by computer scientists is de-identified. And I think it has a lot less connotative baggage than anonymize, but I think it has the same underlying problem. Right? You haven't de-identified people. You've removed identifiers. But whether or not you de-identify them is still open for debate and research. So I don't like either of those words. Yeah.
Degrade.
Oh, that's interesting.
Congress does all of us.
You're also getting at
the utility. Yeah, that's not a bad. I mean, you've got that strange negative connotation on it, right? You're all deviant degraders, is what you are. But no, that's an interesting idea, and bringing in utility is kind of a nice trick. I like that. And then with anonymized, again, same problem. I talk in my paper about this, and this is hence the title of the talk. Is the probability of privacy. So what technique did you apply, and what has the research suggested about that particular technique? And then again, I'm not even going to reiterate that because I've said enough, this link between utility and anonymity. Okay, so six prescriptions. I'm going to put them up, talk about them briefly, and we can see what you want to talk about. So the first is we should just regulate the probability of privacy. We should end our project of suggesting that anonymized data falls outside any particular prohibition. And in its place, we should have a new regime which says, you are now graded based on the steps you took to scrub the data. And the treatment under the law varies based on what step you took. Of course, there's a problem here, right? I doubt, I know computer scientists will never be able to give me a rubric for grading at a fine level of granularity. They'll never be able to say, oh, that's a 27, or that's a 73. I suspect and hope they can give me three tiers. They can say, given, and I'll get to your question in 2 seconds, given the latest research, this is a completely inadequate technique, because the re-identifiability is imminent, or this is a really, really, really good technique. So every morning when I'm on travel, I pick up the USA Today, right, that is left in my hotel, and in the bottom left I have the graph of what Americans think about some important news topic. I have pretty good faith that that's sufficient anonymization to protect the privacy of the survey respondents. And I imagine computer scientists could be better than I just was in saying that rigorously. And then we'd have this interesting middle category where you're taking some trade-offs. You're increasing the utility of your data in order to assure a little bit more anonymity, but you could do more. And it's in that middle range where the legislatures are going to have to be very clever about how we treat them. Maybe we give the people who are vigorous, a complete pass, get out of jail free. Maybe the people who blunder get no special treatment. And if you're in the middle, then it turns on things like intent, or it turns on things like magnitude of harm that resulted, that kind of thing. Yes?
The feds approach that with their regulations about human subject data, which is what FERPA now directly refers to in the revised
regulations. The IRB, you mean the IRB regulations. Yeah, and more to the point, HIPAA, which I've...
What, 12 factors of data of identification?
Yeah, so HIPAA has...
HIPAA has some of that.
Yeah, FERPA, I mean, both the IRB regulations that are promulgated and HIPAA. You know, when I started this project, I thought I had this sentence early on that I couldn't prove that said, oh, and even HIPAA needs to be updated. It's woefully inadequate. The more I get my fingers dirty with HIPAA, I begin to think, you know, that's not an unreasonable approach. And maybe if all we do is we replicate HIPAA, this is going to scare people in the audience. If there's any libertarians, close your ears right now. Maybe if we expand HIPAA to cover all data, so we have the Data Safe Handling Act of 2009, maybe that's not a bad way to start. Okay. All right, second, focus much less on sensitivity. This is in large part because of what the Netflix people have taught us and the concept of entropy, right? This obsession with giving you a free pass once you take the sensitive information out, that's part of the problem, right? That is an insufficient response. Post-Netflix, there was this weird debate that occurred, and no one called them out on the weirdness of the debate. People said, who cares if you know what movie I've watched? Right? I don't care. And the Netflix researchers said, no, you should care. Why should you care? Well, I'll give you two reasons. One, the Video Privacy Protection Act, right? So Congress cares, which to me was like impugned their argument, didn't support it. And then the other argument, which is a little more interesting and compelling, in fact it was very interesting, was they took 50 random users from the Internet Movie Database who had expressed their thoughts about movies. And they had discovered that two of them, beyond a statistical shadow of a doubt, were also in the Netflix database. 28 standard deviations above random chance were in the Netflix database. And from that, they learned things from each database that were not revealed in the other. So they knew that this individual, who had all sorts of things to say about Christian-themed movies, for some reason was also rating gay-themed movies. And so again, they were pushing. They were engaging these critics by saying, no, this is more sensitive than you think. I think that's the wrong response. I think the response is entropy, right? We've got this database that is the key to another database, that is the key to a third database, that's the key to the one that we're really, really afraid of revealing. And if you've reduced my entropy, you've begun to harm me, or you've set up the conditions to harm me that regulators may care about, right? Especially if it's something that really, really does. So the easiest way to understand this is usernames. So say I find through a database that we could care less about the username that you've selected on that website. What are the odds that I know the username you've selected on 55 other websites? Pretty high, I would suggest. What if I run one of those websites, right? And I know that you've been chatting about some embarrassing ailment that you've been suffering, and I notice that there's a user with similar username on the Internet Movie Database, right? I'm going to begin to piece things together and find you, I think, with some relative ease. So that's why I care much less about sensitivity. Regulate the implicit disclosure of information. Every time you see the word directly in a statute, like I showed you with FERPA, strike it, or put in the word directly or indirectly. Fourth, regulate quantity as much as quality. So our laws care a lot about what you keep. They say almost nothing about how much you keep. So where this comes up most often is the FTC and the European Union looking at data retention policies of ISPs. And suggesting that maybe 90 days after you no longer need the information, you should just remove it.
Not just ISPs.
Not just ISPs, right?
Google.
Right, right. Well, Google is an ISP as far as I'm concerned, but not under a lot of the laws, right? this is broad. Stem the flow of outside information. One researcher who used to work, I think, for Cynthia Dwork, he's now at Penn State, and his name is escaping me right now. He noted that in some states it costs $20,000 to get the DMV database. In other states, it's completely free. So as a very simple measure, let's not sell that stuff for free anymore, especially data that the government holds. And then six is, I want to see these laws focus on the insider as much as the outsider, right? And they tend not to. So the question I've asked, hypothetically, is after the Netflix study was released, did anyone in Google, you know, because some researchers in Google get access to the search database on their desktop, did anyone happen to try and figure out if they could re-identify people based on their Google queries? I'll never know the answer to that, but I would not be shocked to learn that someone had done that. And our law tends to ignore them, right? They're part of the corporate mothership. They're part of the unitary body of data holders. Let's not regulate inside that corporate veil. I think this is an argument, at least, to maybe start to pierce that a little bit.
So after the AOL database thing happened, Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, was quoted as saying, "We will never do this," right? And that was as a result of the huge backlash that resulted. But one way of ensuring that Google would never do it, even more than just a bad PR, would have been if AOL had gotten sued. And one thing I don't see on this list is private cause of action and civil liability for these kinds of releases. And I think if we held LexisNexis and Reed Elsevier and these companies that are amassing ChoicePoint and all these other private databases, if we held them responsible, they would have a significantly lower incentive to then collect and combine these data sets.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and you're right. I mean, I tended to focus more on the substantive structure of these laws as opposed to how we enforce these laws, but you're right. I mean, I see it as a little separate move from this project, but how do we get better enforcement of these laws is a separate and interesting question. Like, AOL is before the FTC. No, AOL was sued. AOL was sued.
Was it successful?
No, they're still in litigation. I think they survived a motion to dismiss already. So AOL was sued, and we'll soon learn whether they suffer liability. But you're right. I mean, there is a lot of consensus out there among law professors that when a problem is sufficiently important, there's no better enforcement mechanism than a good class action lawsuit provision, right? Because then you deputize the plaintiff's bar to go out and make lots of money on behalf of whatever cause you're trying to forward. I mean, there's a lot of law professors who would then say, well, we shouldn't do it nevertheless. But I think there's agreement that it's a good way to get lots of churn in the enforcement mechanism. Yeah.
Part of the insider question, FERPA, in part of the redo of FERPA recently, has refocused on what they call appropriate educational purpose. So that the Rooker, when he was here, was talking about if you're a freshman advisor, you should only be able to see data about freshmen.
Oh, really?
That you're not supposed to be able
to see others. That sounds like an expensive set of infrastructure.
And he points out that it could be an expensive set of infrastructure. But the point is that this, and FERPA has this, as does the new mass regulation on high-risk data, people with an appropriate use for the data can see the use.
Again, it's entirely sensible, and it could flow directly from what I'm saying, but my mind is racing with all the practical problems.
Impossible. put as broad a brush on as possible. We can't do it.
You know, before I get to the last slide, which is what I'm hoping to get from the computer science community, I'll put a punctuation mark here, which is, in a way that I think I'm going to address in my next paper. I think these prescriptions are getting me closer to the European rights-based conception of privacy protection, but while still not taking my eye off the harm ball. That's a horrible metaphor. But I have always written from the place of still caring about harm when it comes to privacy and privacy risks. And I've always written from this position of, no, let's not give up on the harm project yet. There are other colleagues in my field who have, in a sense, given up on the harm project. And they've said, no, there's something more philosophically fundamental at risk here. It's the ability of all of us to try on masks, to become autonomous human beings, to engage in a liberal society, to take part in a deliberative democracy. Yeah, I mean, what's that?
You said autonomous.
Autonomous. Autonomy. So these are people who think, if I don't have privacy, I can't really realize my full potential as a human being. Right? Straight line from liberal philosophical theory. And although I found all of that writing very, very good and very interesting, I'm also not surprised that it's had little impact on policy. Because policymakers could care less, right, about these abstract notions. Maybe they will in a generation, but right now they don't. They care a lot about harm. And so I see like this as a step in kind of bringing together the broad sweeping conclusions that they come to, but by doing it with one eye on harm. Okay, so here are the five things I hope to get from computer scientists, and I'll just put these up there and see if there's any remaining questions. One, why this recent flood of results? I can imagine the internet is an important part of that. Computational power is an important part of that. It would be a really interesting thing for me to hear that this has always been a problem, we just haven't been savvy about it until recently. That would, I don't know if that would flow directly into a policy conclusion, but I'd be interested to hear that. Second, the computer scientists always model this as an outsider adversary model, right? It's always you release data, someone else re-identifies. Does anything change if you consider this as the insider model? I know enough about computer security research to think, well, the problems get harder, but nothing fundamentally changes. But I'd like to talk to people about that. Third, this accretion result, this entropy result, is always mentioned, not even always, is rarely mentioned and always in passing. And I want to know if there's any more kind of thorough treatments of it. Fourth, this is important for my probability of privacy conclusion. What are the hallmarks of these various techniques? Which types of databases are harder to anonymize or not? The beginning of the evolution of a rubric or a hierarchy is important for this project. And how many levels of risk are discernible? Again, if you give me three, I'm happy. But if someone told me, no, we can actually give you five tiers, that'd be great. I doubt it, but that'd be great. Okay, any further questions? Yes?
I'm a little bit unclear on the insider-outsider threat distinction.
Yeah.
What is the threat model for the insider that you have in mind? I'm having trouble differentiating that from just what companies do and, you know, marketing their...
So I have two responses. The first may be, I bet a computer scientist would say, no, it's the same model. You just call them the adversary wherever they are, right? You can always draw a line and call this one inside and that outside. The more specific response is the bored employee. So, you know, the employee...
Or corrupt.
Or the corrupt employee, right. So you know, my favorite term in law, I started saying this and then I want to make sure I can remember it, is frolic and detour. So if you're an employer, your agent is you're no longer liable for the actions of your agent if the court decides they were on a frolic or detour. And so I worry about the frolicking and the detouring employee, the bored Google employee, the jealous husband, the corrupt employee. That's the insider threat I worry about. So again, a computer scientist may say, ah, that's an outsider, right? The math works the same if we just consider them outsiders.
Well, one area where people are worried about insiders is health privacy, right? They have nurses giving crap. So non-theoretical problem. Oh, sorry. One area where people are worried about the insider threat is with health privacy. People are working in hospitals.
The solution there is the costs of lack of access vastly outweigh the...
Yeah.
Sorry, false. You know, type 1 is so much worse than type 2 that you dump it to audit. And so every computer science paper has section 9. We will also log data for audits. And I have not seen a single paper that actually looks at how do you do a good, robust access audit. And the only thing we have is sort of stuff dumped in from the IDS.
It's very, very hard. The medical profession is working on that now, and it is very, very hard.
Yes?
Alan's comments are sort of getting the place that there is a difference, the times that there is a difference between insider and outsider is when there is different access to the system. And, you know, clearly you can't do anything about scrubbing, to use your terminology, against an insider who has access to the pre-scrubbed data. So I think that's the sort of thing to think about in terms of a model.
Yeah.
What is there intermediate between having access to the raw data, the pre-scrubbed data, and the scrubbed data? Is there something in between? That's where you might find a way.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm self-consciously assuming away the access issue, which is a huge part of this, right? I mean, and I forget that, you know, there's this holy trio of ways you protect privacy, and one is through collecting less, and one is through access controls, and I forget the third is training or something, but the bottom line is, once you layer access back onto this, and once you assume that access controls work sufficiently well, then maybe the policy response is a little different, and especially in the academic research world. I think the answer in the academic research world is probably access controls. Right? Allow data to flow a little bit more freely than in the rest of society, but boy, you better start putting in two-factor authentication and everything else, and making sure that your board grad student isn't pouring through the data when they're not thinking about research. I think that's going to be a large part of the solution. Yes?
I'm missing one part in your presentation, which is, I think, the fundamental one. The question, who owns or has certain rights at what time on the data?
Yeah.
And I don't want to open that, but I would like to recommend to you that you look at the paper by Rakesh Agarwal on Democratic Database.
Yes, yes, yes. You're the second person who's told me that in one of these talks.
I think that gives at least a high-level view of how to get a different approach.
Yeah.
The whole thing, which helps, not probably to solve the problem, but at least to get another additional handle on it.
Yeah, I mean, in the law world, the version of that in the law world is when I describe this cadre of writers who are turning to moral philosophy, they did so in direct response, and this may not be exactly what you mean, to kind of the property ownership camp of law professors who came first, who said, who owns it and who can give it away?
Data for a particular purpose.
Yes.
I think that needs to be recorded and to be respected in one way or another.
Yes.
And that could really help to get a better handle on this.
Yeah, I mean, so those of you who have been well steeped in this stuff know about the Fair Information Practices, which has informed a lot of what they've done in Europe and some of what we've done here, and that's one of the central tenets of these Fair Information Practices, is limited use for limited purposes and some sort of mechanism to make sure they don't use it for other purposes. You know, the countervailing thing is once you start playing with ideas of ownership, then you start playing with ideas of consent. And that's where the train jumps off the tracks because so I know Alessandro Acquisti was recently here, but his interesting work in behavioral economics and privacy and why we all seem to be very dumb lizard-brained individuals when it comes to clicking the I agree button. That's too simple, but that's why a lot of law professors have kind of abandoned or moved away from highly propertized notions of privacy. But I definitely want to, you're the second person who's brought up the Hippocratic database concept, so I definitely want to look at that next. Okay.
So with regard to the accretion issue, I think there's actually a really good comparison that can be made to cryptography.
Yeah.
When we encrypt a database now, you don't just consider what capabilities are available to the attacker today. You say, okay, I want this database to be secure for 10 years.
Yep.
I know that, you know, we assume that Moore's law is going to remain accurate. We know that people in 10 years are going to have this much power. Mm-hmm. Maybe there'll be some class breaks, some new technologies that will come out. And so I'm going to use this many bits for my encryption algorithm with the understanding that my data set will then remain encrypted for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, if you can somehow say, okay, people are revealing this much data about themselves at this rate, maybe you
assume that the growth curve will continue.
Right, and so then you're saying, okay, we desire anonymity for 5 years or 10 years, or non-linkability.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't know how you would define or map the rate of entropy loss.
Right.
But if you could do something, you might have something there.
Problem is we can only start with 33 bits. We're not like cryptography. Keep selecting bigger and bigger keys.
Right. And we're giving up more information.
Well, there are more people being born, but not as
exactly. That is a limiting factor.
Right.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I think if you add these six things together and then some, you basically come up with a general idea that this is an argument for just generally stemming the amount of information flowing around our society. Right? I mean, this is the most aggressive form of my argument, and I think it's similar to what you were just saying. That whether we do it through regulation or best practices or what, we live in a society where information, you know, the skids are greased well for information to flow very rapidly. And these are arguments for suggesting that that may not always be the right decision. There's all sorts of counterarguments to that, right? Like, the only thing that seems to work in our economy these days is selling you ads based on your preferences. So how can you talk about less information flow? But it's just an argument. I mean, it's just part of this way. And I don't know if I got to your point.
Trying
to
focus on harm. The problem is that it's
a
very non-local definition
of harm. Yes.
I don't know how the law deals with that.
No, that's right. And so, he, again, this next paper that I'm describing, so basically what Dan Solov and Paul Schwartz and these other leading thinkers in privacy have done is they've said, let's define the harm of privacy much more abstractly. And I'm trying to do this slowly because I haven't formulated this well yet. What I say in contrast is, no, let's have really concrete harms, but let's be willing to accept much more speculative paths to those harms, right? And so I think that's a slight twist on what they're doing, but I think it's what you were just saying. It's a weird form of harm. It's inchoate. It's the burglar tools almost. But that's what I want to do. I want to say I still have a really concrete, like the end of the day, I'm always going to talk about the person who has HIV and doesn't want anyone to know, or doesn't want her health insurance to know, or her employer to know, or is gay, or whatever else secret that could harm someone. That is going to be, at the end of the day, what I'm worried about, but I'm going to allow for much more math and speculation about how we get there. So I don't know if that's satisfying, but it's my response to what they've been doing. Yes?
As an academic, how does this play with some of the recent advances we've finally gotten in transparency?
With government transparency?
With academic transparency of data.
Are you talking about just the
cultural norms that
and Harvard in particular with its open scholarship initiatives?
Yes, journals in particular, but published results. But
yeah,
the idea that the norm is now finally getting to be
early on chapter
published without public data.
Yeah, early on part 5 was impact on academic research, and I realized no, you cannot do that as part 5. Right, that's another paper. And that is probably a series of papers, and it's a hard problem. And I've been singing the praises of HIPAA, but everything you read about HIPAA is it's made the lives of academic researchers much more difficult. And you know the quote I've seen attributed to someone I can't remember is the legendary landmark health disease study that occurred a few decades ago.
Framingham
would not have occurred under HIPAA. Could not have occurred under HIPAA.
Most of those are misreading of.
Okay. Well, and again, FERPA and HIPAA, I'm not...
That matters. I agree, it matters, but it's very frustrating to watch people...
Misreading is another way of saying, like, an overcautious reading or an overprotective reading, right? And there's virtue in sometimes being overcautious, right? Would that some of our government officials were a little more overcautious some of the times. But you're right. I'm definitely being weaselly here in tabling this, because it's a really hard problem. But it's one that I'm sympathetic to, and I'll leave a marker in this paper to let the reader know that I'm not assuming it away. I'm just putting it off for another day.
Academic openness doesn't mean that you publish everybody's grades.
No, but the data sets, right?
The idea is that economics is far behind this, but you shouldn't publish without a public database that allows people to do it. In fact, Gary King requires his students in the intro class, this class, replicate a study. And he says that about 30% of studies are just wrong. They published academics.
It also is going to cut against the government transparency movement, right? So this idea that Obama is going to put all of the public data sets on the web, I mean, that starts to sound a lot like what the well-intentioned people in Massachusetts were doing. So
what's your take on that? Because one of your prescriptions, prescription number 5 is to stem the flow of outside information.
Yeah. Right, and you know, like, so I'm presenting this at Princeton in a few weeks, where they've done some really interesting work recently on releasing government databases in a form. I think the prescription they have is, we want it in the exact same form you had it in when you did your analysis, right? No more, no less. But I worry a lot about that. I mean, and I don't know if I have a take on it. I mean, access controls are going to be a piece of it. Here's one thing. In privacy, too often you hear this this bromide that says, oh, you can have privacy and security and you could have it all, and we're all, you know, we'll link arm in arm and we'll walk off into the happy place. And I don't think that's right. I think privacy is a drag on efficiency, a drag on research, a drag on innovation. It's a drag on all these things, but it's an acceptable drag often. And we're left where we always are with policy and balancing. And so there's a balance here. And so maybe, and it may not be me, but maybe the idea is we just have to incorporate that into the balance. And in sum, that probably means less government revelation of this information. Like, I view this in a very narrow way because I'm partially involved in this movement to get more court records onto the internet. And people have realized that court records are full of social security numbers and deep secrets about people, and they're supposed to be redacted, but they never are. And I mean, as much as I want all those court records online, and as important as I think that is for government transparency, I'm really worried about those people, so I'm not sure. I don't know where I come out on that. So, yeah.
I found the relationship to cryptography to be really interesting, but the big difference I see is cryptography is inherently probabilistic, and there is a notion of the effort required.
Yeah.
You can never say something is perfectly encrypted.
Right.
It's just how many machine hours is it going to take before, on average, someone has cracked it.
Right.
So I wonder, I feel like, given the argument that you're making, you know, if I have already revealed 5 of my bits in different databases all over the world that are very hard to get to,
yes.
If I went and I combined them all into some very easily, you know, I made the links.
Yeah.
And then I published that. I have not revealed any more of bits.
Right.
But I made it much more easy for people to get to.
Yes. Yes.
So
right.
Is that now? Am I breaking any laws here? Like, should that be prevented?
Well, I'd ask a different question, which is like, is this a difference that privacy should care about, or that a conversation that should
right
that theories of privacy should incorporate? Right. So in law, sometimes you hear this described as the practical obscurity argument. Right. And so. So I bet if I turn the fact pattern around and make it about the government, there are going to be people who say, oh, of course that's a violation, right? So as the Supreme Court has said many times, you can stick an electronic GPS beeper on someone's rear bumper and track them all around town for weeks and weeks and weeks because, you know, you could have sent a cop after him for weeks and weeks and weeks. He would have had to feed him and find restrooms and all sorts of other things, and he would have tried to shake his tail and he would have lost you a few times, but the courts assume all of that away. And they say, no, it just means it's a little more expensive. And they've just found an efficient way to do what they could have done anyway. And so at least as a matter of Fourth Amendment search and seizure law, courts have said, that's not the privacy we care about. But a lot of reasonable people have said, no, you should care about that, right? That making things easier is sometimes the entire game, right? And I'm one of them. I mean, I think that is a privacy violation as far as I'm concerned, even if it's just making things much, much more efficient.
So someone might argue, I don't think this is 100% true, but someone might argue that there isn't more information today. It's just much more available.
Yeah.
I could have flown to courthouses and asked to go for records and et cetera,
yeah.
But no one's going to do that. You find I can only identify 2 people a year because it's so darn expensive.
Yeah. We're talking about a spectrum here, and if the question you're asking is, should we imagine a line in this spectrum where we go from something of minimal concern to something of great concern, I think absolutely. That line's very, very hard to draw precisely, but I can at least point to the endpoints pretty easily.
I guess also if I'm concerned that someone might say, you know, I release some data set and you say, oh, that you just identified a bunch of people or taken off some of their bits, that's bad. Couldn't I just say this information was already public,
right.
Just less accessible?
You could say that, but I think my laws would suggest that that's not a sufficient response. All right, I think we're over time, but I'd love to take some of the top lines.